Blog Talk Radio.
Life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all you need. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes, so write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out loud. Own who you are, stand up proud. You got
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. And this is a wonderful Wednesday night in Lexington, Kentucky for episode number 325.
No, it's Thursday night.
Thursday, it is. You're right. I slipped, didn't I? It is Thursday night. Thank you. And that is Holly. Holly Phillippe, the one, the only, the vivacious, the lovely Holly Phillippe. And I am here just for a moment to help get the show kicked off. Because tonight it's just going to be Holly in the hosting spot, and I'm going to be changing chairs here in a few minutes, which should be a lot of fun. Haven't done so in a while, but I've been doing a lot of work these past couple years, and yeah, I got a few things that I think would be fun to talk about, and so you know that I'm very constructive with my time and have been very productive, so I will prove that tonight, so I hope. But Holly is going to be in the host spot and is going to be asking questions, and we're going to be taking questions from the chat room. And I see Tommy Smith is in there, and that's great because Tommy B. Smith, you know, of course, can always come bring the good questions and insights. So yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. So we're not going to beat around the bush too much. It is, as Holly said, it's a special Thursday night. We did intend to be back on our normal Wednesdays, but Holly needed another day to get back to form for hosting, and Daniel should be back with us next week. He's still doing a little recovering after the big convention. So tonight, of course, we do, as always, have two wonderful individuals that brought you the show tonight. One, the one and only Sandy Lender, the Genre Blender, and Sandy is awesome, and we've got a spot from her to share with you. And then also the Ren Garcia, who incidentally will be making a return. He had to miss because of a family emergency a few weeks back. We do have him rescheduled for next week. So finally, we will get that episode with Ren Garcia and some of those paranormal tales that he was going to tell us all about. And he was really wanting to talk to Holly about it. So he's been really looking forward to the show next week. And it's going to be a good one, and we'll have Ren back. But tonight, he is one of the two that brought you the show. So I'm going to go ahead and give you a little bit from Sandy, and then we'll give you the famous spot from Ren with the famous question. Here's a little bit about Sandy.
Are you looking for an inexpensive vacation plan? There's a lovely bed and breakfast that author Sandy Lender can recommend with her Fairy Holiday series of paranormal romances. Of course, the Rose Chateau is owned by a reluctant vampire. You might prefer a staycay in mid-Missouri with Dr. Noble Galen. Of course, he might be going insane. So, Sandy could whisk you away to the fantasy realms of Onveld or Frumshaft, or to outer space where there be dragons of all shapes and sizes. What I'm saying is you have options for all manner of cool and clever creatures in the Girl Power Stories by the author Sandy Lender. Take a minute to check out her offerings to see what inexpensive vacation plan you can schedule tonight. There's always a new adventure being announced on Sandy Lender's Amazon page.
Thank you, Sandy. Sandy is awesome. Hope Sandy gets a chance to drop in tonight, definitely just at least to say hi. Thank you very much for your support, Sandy. And now I'll go over to Ren with the famous spot and the famous question.
The League of Elder dares to be unusual. It's easy to be swept away in this bold and uninhibited landscape where fantastic heroes become old friends and sinister villains inhabit every dark corner. Dare to explore things best left alone. Each book is your lantern, lighting the path to a world never before seen. So what do you say? Are you weird enough for us?
We yes, are indeed Ren. Weird enough for you, Ren Garcia.
Tonight you have a positive answer from both of us, Ren. Thank you very much for support of the Star Chamber show. And yes, it will be a fun one. And so right now I'm going to switch chairs, figuratively speaking, and Holly is going to take over the host seat because we do this once in a while, yeah, where I, you know, definitely talk about what I've been doing creatively. I try not to talk about it too much on all the other shows. So every once in a while, yeah, I do need a night to talk a little bit about what I actually do all the time because I write on a near daily basis, and it's the first thing I do in the day, and definitely at the heart and core of everything I am about. So anyway, chairs have been switched. Holly, you're it. Tag.
Yes, George. I am going to excuse me if I cough or something like that. I'm still in recovery, but we're going to get through this, and we're going to learn more about Zimmer tonight and what he's working on for his own author stuff. So we always hear about everybody else's, and Stephen, you know, is a freelance editor too, and we're also a publisher. So, you know, we work on everybody else's stuff too, but he also has his own books. Several are in the pipeline. I got to get my editing hat back on. After Imaginarium, I've been crashed ever since. But I'm fully getting back on the path now and can finish up some of his works here. But Stephen, why don't you go ahead and tell them the one I'm currently working on is A Moment of Eternity. Let's talk about that one first. What is that about?
Okay, so we're going to start from the smallest to the largest, I think, of the projects that we have going on, which will be a lot of fun, actually, because this is going to give you all a scoop for listening tonight. You guys are going to get insights into something brand spanking new. It is set in one of my existing worlds, but this is a really, really fun one. I do think, Tommy, I think you especially will find this one very intriguing for sure. Tonight, the works that we are discussing encompass about 750,000 words. I'm not joking. We got five projects to talk about that are four of which are complete and in the pipeline, one of which is probably going to have the first draft complete in sometime in early August, I hope, if all goes well. But this is one of the completed projects, probably going to be out. Definitely going to be the first one to see the light of day as far as the market is concerned. And that would be A Moment of Eternity that Holly is referring to. And it is set in the same world as Ragnar Stormbringer and Raiden Valkyrie. So it's set during the same age, the same world. Raiden and Ragnar are out there running about in other parts of that world as the story takes place, but they are not a part of the story. This introduces a brand new character, and this has been a lot of fun because I've always wanted to explore this because in my Fires in Eden series, I do have a nation in it that's based on the League of the Iroquois and from the Five Tribes period, not the later Six Nations period, but the earlier Five Tribes period. And I do love delving back into a lot of that lore in the Americas. And one thing I wanted to really dig into was what was going on in the American Southwest. I love, you know, the tribal peoples in the Southwest, some of the stories, the lore, the creatures, the myths, all that kind of stuff. And so yes, this takes place in that type of setting where I have a main character. His name's Hong Vi, and that's how you pronounce it, and translates in Hopi to basically strong. And but he's his full moniker is Hongvi Shadowwalker, and he is a member of a people that's based on the ancestral Puebloans, and they more commonly in the past are referred to as the Anasazi. But if you talk to the Hopi and others, you know, they don't like that term very much as far as when referring to the you know, their ancestors, and so the preferred thing is the ancestral Puebloans, and so I tend to kind of go with that when describing it. The Navajo also inspired a tribal group that's in this, and it gets into a lot of Southwestern lore because there's a lot of really fascinating lore that involves giants. Of course, you got skinwalker lore. You have lots of dark witchcraft, and dark magic was really feared in that, you know, in that culture and time. And so, and then you've got, of course, the cliff dwellings and the big mystery, you know, behind the cliff dwellings, how they were designed, where they were located, what possibly could have happened, you know, because basically the ancestral Puebloans, you know, go up to these cliff dwellings and more or less vanish off the historical record and leave just a very fascinating, intriguing collection of like pictographs and things like that that have some really interesting stuff when you dig into the history of it. And so I thought it'd be fun to kind of integrate cultures and a setting that's based on that kind of world and then follow it where it may lead. So this is about the warrior Hongvi Shadowwalker, and they are hearing rumors of giants that are drawing closer to where their tribal lands are, and they have recently their elder councils have already made the move to go to the cliff dwellings and form those, and so they do live in the cliff dwelling type villages, and so, you know, in this beautiful scenic, kind of canyon mesa kind of setting. It's really, you know, I think the story brings that through, kind of how gorgeous the setting is. And it also brings in, like I said, some of the really darker, kind of scarier stuff involving even like Chaco Canyon and some of the legends with that. And follows the story of how Hongvi goes to investigate these tales of giants coming near to his lands, and also at the same time what he encounters, because there are more or less sorcerers that have come and formed taken rulership over a region to the south, and they're ruling out of a city. And they are, you know, steeped in dark magic, and kind of the tribes that they've come to influence, they've kind of put on a war footing, and they're taking, you know, captives and slaves from neighboring areas, which of course includes Hongvi's people's lands. And so yes, there's a whole lot going on in the setting of the story. And as Hongvi sets out to, you know, check into these lore of these giants, he gets caught up in quite a tale that involves all these kind of conflicting elements. And you're gonna, you know, like I said, draws into all the kind of lore and fun stuff of that region. I do, of course, always I love to invent creatures that fit well within these settings, and so there's some original creatures of my own that come into it. It definitely more or less plays in a kind of ancient world heroic fantasy kind of feel in some ways, but it also definitely draws elements of mystery, horror, and kind of sprinkling of other genre influences, and that's my take on it. But Holly has been editing it, so she can go ahead and give her take without giving too much away. Did I explain it well enough?
Well, I don't want to do spoilers, but the world is fascinating, and it does delve into, you know, nonfiction, because you did go back and do the historical research, you know. So it's almost like a alternate history story, you could call it, too, mixed with fantasy and sword and sorcery. And so it's definitely a cross genre, and it will appeal to many people. And I think fascinating. You've got some really neat stories in there, and the whole world, you know, it's a really cool setting. I love how they lived on the side of the cliffs, and you know how you touched on that. And yeah, that's pretty fascinating. That's scary too. I mean, these people, you know, they actually built homes, and they truly did this, you know, in the side of these cliffs, and you had to climb. I mean, it was treacherous. You know, they didn't have, you know, really nice ladders and stuff of modern day. So we're talking, you know, one wrong slip and you're going down the hill. So, yeah. But it's really cool. Yeah. I think a lot of people are going to like it.
They weren't easy to get to, these, and I studied a lot of them. I studied the architecture and layouts of them, and they were definitely designed to be very inaccessible. And there's a lot of conjecture, because nobody really knows exactly why they made that big shift up to those cliff dwellings. A lot of theories, and and if you look at the pictographs that they left, I mean, it raises some really intriguing issues. You know, I mean, and if you are somebody like me that's open to fantastical possibilities in our ancient past, I mean, yeah, that you could take the ball and run with that, and who knows, you know, what really happened and why the you know, ancestral Puebloans disappeared, you know, off the map at one point. And it's a really fascinating thing to think about. But yeah, going digging into the culture and everything was a lot of fun. And Hogvi is very different from Raiden or Ragnar, either one. I mean, he's a distinctly different type of character. He's not based on brawn. He's very much, he's a good hunter. He's very, very stealth oriented. He's very clever, and he's very swift of foot. I mean, he's very, you know, very nimble. So he's very different in his physicality than, say, Ragnar. So, you know, he's very, you know, and he's not an extrovert either. Like Raiden and Ragnar don't mind taking center stage at any given moment. I mean, they can cause a scene and they don't flinch from it. And this character is much more more laid back and more subtle, and as his leadership style, you know, is more quiet. I think that's the best word to say. It's more, but he's very much follows his own drummer. He's very independent, but also within the context of just being fiercely loyal to his family and his tribal people. So yeah, a lot of good stuff, and you know, of course, all characters have their flaws and you know, things that they struggle with, and Hogvi does too. But I think he's one that I think a lot of readers will come to really like and embrace quite a bit. I think he will resonate. He's got a real quiet strength and determination about him.
I do. And I have in between some of these books that we're going to be talking about that you've got coming out, I've got some really cool questions too I'm going to throw in between, so people could find out more about your process and what goes into your writing style.
Sure.
So before we move on to the next title, I want to ask you, and so that everybody else can know, have you ever considered writing under a pseudonym name? Why and why not?
I have, but the thing is that I haven't gone too far. Too far removed from my core genres to need to do that, to put a entirely different branding, if there's for lack of a better word, on it. There's a possibility that I would do that if I was doing some straight literary fiction at some point, something that's very different from, say, fantasy or dystopian or cross genre or horror. If I was getting away from all those things in a big way, like a literary fiction novel, or maybe just something like a straight alternative history, not anything fantastical, but a straight alt history. There's a possibility that I would use a pen name in those kind of respects, or maybe if I did the children's books, if I did, and I do have one, by the way. It's not part of tonight's discussion, but I do have a wild and crazy one involving cats in ancient Rome. Let's just give you a little teaser, and it's fun. I do have an idea for a really good children's book, and then another one that involves another cat that lived with us named Dubious, And that one is a little different, but I might find a way to actually merge those storylines too. So, but yeah, children's book, literary fiction, alt history, something along those lines. Yes, I would almost consider doing a pen name just to brand it differently, so people didn't get confused.
That's a good answer. Well, let's turn the tails a little bit and delve into some of the horror you write. Not everybody realizes. You do, in fact, write horror, and you have several Hellscapes novels out, but there's going to be a new one, and tell them about the new Hellscapes.
There is, and I completely blamed Tommy B. Smith on this one. Let's it up. Yes, Tommy, I'm going to put you on the spot here. But the second book we're going to talk about, the other one, is a novella, A Moment of Eternity, roughly about, probably about, oh God, how big was that one? About 35K, somewhere in there. It's a good sized novella. But the next one we're going to talk about is the second largest project. It'll be about 65 to 70K. It will be a novel, and it will be the first Hellscapes novel. And to date, I have only done collections. I have done three so far, Hellscapes 1, Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3. They all have kind of a thematic continuity to them, and they are stories that show different hellscapes, literally, where, various characters are finding themselves in a different type of hell, and the story basically is about why they're there and what they're having to deal with, and what got them there, and I think most of the stories make it pretty clear as to why they deserve this type of fate, and so there is a moral to each of the stories. They're not there just to be shocking or that, but I mean, does allow me to play in a sandbox that's a little bit different from the other genres. So I can go, Clive Barker. I love Clive Barker. He's a big influence on me. And I can go in that full throttle, visceral, macabre kind of mode. And I do use it a lot, elements of it when I'm writing my other fiction. But in Hellscapes, yeah, I can go full throttle on it. I mean, we can go full on Dante's Inferno and full on Books of Blood vibes, those kind of thing, those kind of influences. And it's not for all of my readers, but the one, it's interesting to get the response I do from some of the people that read my other stuff that try these. They end up liking them quite a bit, and I think that because there is, I know it sounds odd to say so, but there is a light about the stories, because there's there's a truth to them, there's a moral to them. They're not just written to just be horrific. I mean, there is a purpose, and
they do not have to be read in order. So can read the third book in the series, and then they can go read the first or the second. They do not have to be read in order.
Oh, they're standalones, and that's appealing, of course. And Tommy had actually had suggested a ways back. He thought that it was about time for me to do a third volume of the Hellscapes. And so, yeah, I was like, yeah, you're right, because I have a whole folder filled with ideas for the Hellscapes short stories. And so, that's what kind of led to Hellscapes 3. And so, that's why, I had Tommy actually got to be one of the first readers of it when it was complete, and he gave me a blurb. Thank you, Tommy. Gave me a blurb for the book cover and everything. But then Tommy thought, Stephen, what about a Hellscapes novel? That would be intriguing. I forget the exact word he used, but that is a kind of way Tommy would tell me something. he thought I should try a novel-length Hellscapes story. And I thought, Tommy, I think I can do that, because I had a storyline that was bigger than I could put into a short story. And I thought, it's probably novella-sized. But then the more I looked at it, and the more I thought about it, the more I started kind of scrutinizing it, I thought, this actually could be developed into a novel, without compromising, with having everything, be meaty, no filler. And so the title of it, working title of it, is called Days of Darkness. And this one has a scale that's probably a little bit bigger than the Hellscape short stories. It takes place in the modern day, has a very apocalyptic feel to it because it sort of takes in a little bit about some stuff from a Catholic lore, even about the Days of Darkness, which is a trial period where the whole world falls into darkness, and basically the dark spirits are let out for a time to terrorize the world, and it's a really fascinating thing that I came across. As far as that. And I thought, I can take the ball and run with that for this. So it follows a lead character who, is in the heart of a big city, and suddenly the entire world that he's in goes, the temperature just drops, plummets, and becomes ice cold, followed by this cloaking darkness that falls not only over his city, but it falls over his entire world. And it's a darkness that doesn't go away. The skies are just absolutely cloaked in this just dense, just black cloud mass. And there is no hint of the sun. There's no sunrise the next day. I mean, we're just talking total darkness. Just engulfs the world that he's in. And that's basically how the ball starts rolling. And it just gets worse and worse and worse as the story goes.
Well,
and we find out why he's there.
Oh, go ahead.
And it's just, filled. I mean, Wayne Barlow, who's an artist that's, just amazing horror artist. And, I think Lynn Hansen would like it too, but I think they would have a ball drawing some of the creatures that I've come up with for this. I mean, it's filled with some really nasty stuff. But it's a whole world that falls under this darkness and then it just, the whole story unfurls, and as he slowly finds out what he's a part of now.
you have a couple questions from the chat room. Clayton would like to know if you have read Niven, Pornelli's Inferno and Escape from Hell.
Not yet. No, I'd actually be intrigued to read some of that stuff. I'm always delving into the NDE experiences and stuff. And I've read a lot of accounts of people that have been through NDEs and seen various types of hells. You always hear about the Tunnel of Light stories and the Flowery stories. But, yes, there are actually a lot of NDEs that are less than pleasant, and I have done a lot of research into those. Got a lot of inspiration, actually. For hellscapes from some of those.
Tommy B has a question.
Yeah,
he says, as a writer, what was your experience in approaching a full-length hellscape novel as opposed to a collection this time? Did you find it a more immersive process this time around, perhaps? Was it more immersive this time?
That's a hard question to answer, because whether it's a short story or a novel, when I'm actually in the writing, I am completely immersed. I am similar to Clayton, kind of how Clayton describes his experiences when he's kind of like watching a movie and transcribing it. That's not far removed from kind of what I go through. I get in this like zone, and I can see it vividly in my head and what's going on. And it's kind of like being a spectator almost. And then just getting everything I can down, I want to get down visuals and lots of sensory stuff and the feel and all that. So yes, everything I do is immersive, but that being said, a novel project is, you have to, short stories, you have to get to the point right away. I mean, you only got, 5 or 7,000 or maybe possibly 10,000 words at most to get through a short story. So you have to jump on it. Where a novel, you have that room for development, but you don't want it to be filler. You want it to make sense. You want it to, you want to be able to build on the characters. You have the ability in a novel to introduce other characters and develop them. So most of the Hellscape stories, you pretty much follow a key character. This one does follow primarily a single character narrative, but you do get to see other characters, and there is development for some of them, where they, I'm able to flesh them out more. And then, too, if you've read the Hellscape short stories, you've you've come across these odd figures that, that reappear now and then that are named under different monikers, like, you know, like the Stranger or the Crusher. You know, they have these unique kind of names, and they come and go, and they're like beings. They're almost like tour guides in a way. And some of those characters do make appearances in this novel, and I introduce a new one called the Prophet, and the Prophet's something else. And but they are something that I'm able to play with more. So yeah, there's just more area for me to develop different other things, and I can flesh things out a bit more than I can in a short story. So I guess in terms of immersive, yeah, in the moment, yeah, I'm as immersed in the short story as I am in a longer piece of fiction in the moment. But with this, it does allow me to branch out and explore, you know, some tangents and some other things, and bring other put more focus on some of the characters that are around a main character than I could with a short story. So that's the mm-hmm. kind of fun that I get mm-hmm. as a writer in a longer piece.
Well, and this question, it kind of segues, since we are, you know, talking about the hellscapes, and I know the answer to some of this, but do you find therapeutic benefits to modeling a character after someone you know?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think all writers write what they know, and I think that, you know, unlike anyone, you know, you meet people and you see different personalities, you see different kinds of people, and they definitely, there's no question that they influence characters that you do come up with, and that gives them the realism, I think, that resonates with readers, you know, when you are drawing off of a real inspiration. I mean, I can't say that I have any characters that are like carbon copies of somebody in particular, but I do mm-hmm. have influences for their various characters that are, you know, where I
but
do
get,
do
you
get,
find
you know,
it therapeutic, you know, do you find it therapeutic in writing these characters, whether they're deceased or not, maybe especially like hellscapes, because a lot of that is people getting their karma they deserve, you know.
Yes.
Maybe they did something horrific in their life and then they're getting to pay for it, and
yes,
and so yeah,
yeah.
You feel that it's therapeutic.
Yeah, when I read about real evil in the world or encounter it in the world, and that gives me an idea for a certain character that I put into a hellscape, most certainly. Yeah, that it just gives a better sense of, you know, just realizing the long-term justice, you know, because we don't often see justice carried out in this life. You know, if you're a person of faith, you know, you have your confidence that will be taken care of and addressed in the next world, right? And that's where things like concepts of hell and stuff come in. But mm-hmm. when you're, you know, but in the writing of this, yes, I mean, yeah, it's a chance for you to see justice carried out in this, you know, here, you know, like in a very complete form. And that is therapeutic in a way, because unfortunately it seems like evil mm-hmm. gets away with all too much in the real world.
I think it's good too, because you could, well, there's like times, especially like Dream of the Navigator and stuff, fur babies that have passed on, you know, there's little there's little spoilers in there, you know, you've got to add those into the story, and I always think that's cool.
Oh yes, I'm going to get into that just a little bit, but I'm excited because it's coming together really well, and I think it's a tight story. It has three key phases that kind of unfold during it, with each phase getting progressively more intense and more bizarre and more grand of scale. So the whole story really builds in a structural way all the way through. It's kind of like a, you know, this building tidal wave that comes to a crescendo in the end, and you know, it does draw in, you know, a lot of those, like I said, the kind of just bizarre imagery that you'd find in like Wayne Barlow art or something like mm-hmm. that. It does have maybe a couple hints of Lovecraftian kind of scale to it. You know, there's a lot of things going on in it, and it's really evolved nicely. And that's been the tough part, is just making sure that I keep channeled you know, with the main character's kind of path, because there's so much exciting stuff going on around them that, you know, I don't want to get distracted too much, but I still want to give the reader
right.
a glimpse as to what's going on, you know, so that's the big challenge in this is, you know, is keeping that camera focused in the right direction without becoming a distraction.
What Beck wants to know if she could make a request for some people to get justice in the book.
Well, there's always Hellscapes Volume 4, and I will definitely, I've got lots of ideas, so yes, we can work on that. And there's probably people that both Beck and I know that are probably already percolating in my head on that, so yes. Yes, Beck. Yeah, there's lots of inspiration for some of those types of characters. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it is. It plays like a Dante's Inferno. It does, and we're each person gets the appropriate karma, if for lack of a better word, in the story, you know, and it's you know, that does play out, and there's no exception with this either, and you know, and then you have the kind of foggy, all the characters have a foggy kind of amnesia to start the stories with in the Hellscapes short stories, and I made sure I kept that consistent in the novel, where the lead character is having problems with memory and things like that. He can't put, there's certain things he can't put together where the reader is going to see, aha, you know, I know where he is now, and that's going to be fun, yeah, especially if readers are familiar with the short stories. They'll see it coming together before the main character does.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
then we did talk about Treatment of the Navigator, so let's talk about switching gears again. We're going into young adult now, about the Far Away Saga Book 2, The Rise of the Voyagers. Let's touch on it. What's that a
Loved
what again
it.
About?
I am really excited about that. Rise of the Voyagers is the second in the Far Away Saga, following Dream of the Navigator, and it really takes off like a rocket, I mean, from the first book. I mean, the world is established, characters are established, so this one allows me to really just get into the depths of the story, you know, both for the non-physical realms, like Far Away, for, you know, even exploring, like, space and time with the, you know, with different, going to different settings in the same universe as this, you know, as the Technates are set in. It's set in that near future where the whole world is a technocracy. And I don't want to give away much, but there are parts of the world that aren't quite under the control of the technocracy, and that's one of the most fun elements about this, because I finally get to kind of go into those areas and reveal some things, and you know, it gets into, you know, all kinds of things like boutique DNA editing, you know, where people, you know, basically, you know, well, in this case, the very elite or wealthy people are using, you know, DNA editing to basically have boutique children that are grown in pods, you know, and they're not even like grown in the womb in this case, and they're lab grown babies. And so there's a lot of interesting and a little bit creepy stuff involving technology. Cloning, mm-hmm. The ideas of artificial intelligence. Yeah, very, you know, and don't worry, Clayton, it's very different from your world, but the way that AI is used in this world, and then the way that, you know, even like space exploration is done using AI, in this particular world, and, the kind of dystopian / utopian kind of fusion that there is. I mean, it does. One of the fun things about this is it's not totally dystopian like 1984. It's not totally utopian like Brave New World, but it combines elements of both. So the you know, the big technates, the, you know, they're no longer cities, but they're just these almost like these full on steroid smart cities, that where everybody lives basically, unless you're of great wealth and influence, in which case, you know, you go anywhere you want. But if you're just one of the 99.9%. Yeah, you're living crammed into these, you know, ginormous kind of housing units, and it's a kind of a technological nightmare, and a lot of people, you know, pretty much escape into the virtual world. It's just to pass the time, and it's yeah, it's a lot of commentary, I think, about where things, I think, are headed, but the storyline is really intense, because, like I said, you know, some individuals, and there, in this case, there's some younger individuals that discovered a way out, you know, through this the kind of realm of like the navigators and then the voyagers, and we get into more about what the voyagers are in this one, and how they can access, you know, higher realms and you know, almost like spiritual or non-physical realms, and they like the consciousness and dreamscapes and things like that, and it gets behind what's really underlying all of it, and the kind of struggle that's going on underneath the surface, you know, for the souls and spirits of humankind. And so it does take on a kind of a cosmic element in a way, without you know, doesn't get preachy or anything like that, but it does get into, you know, a kind of a spiritual dimension and you know, underlying this whole technological structure. And it's a lot of fun because it's got a lot of dark edges. It's got a lot of intensity to it. It's got action, a lot of action, and some pretty scary antagonists once you get into who they are. So yeah, it's
and
YA,
what came?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Okay. What came first with this? Was it the plot or was it the characters that sparked the idea to write this series?
This one, the setting of the techniques, just had this just dread feeling of dread and feel and vision of what a technique would be in like a near future if everything was kind of corralled in a technological sense, and what, you know, what kind of nightmare it would be to live in that, ultimately, for somebody like me. And I thought, well, what if you were born into that kind of world and you felt like, you know, trapped in it and you didn't like it. And, you know, then once I started thinking about that, all of a sudden, you know, some characters started stepping forward to tell their stories. And you know, before, you know, and I thought about a few different ones before but I focused on an ensemble of four. There's four primary character threads that I follow in this story, and you know, so it's not on the same scale of character threads as some of my other larger series, but it's but you do get the chance to kind of change perspectives quite a bit in the book, and then a couple of the characters kind of, you know, without getting into it too much, you know, kind of go, you know, one direction, and the other, another couple go in another different direction. So you do get to see kind of like a, from the antagonist and protagonist kind of views of the greater storyline. You do get to see both sides just based on where the characters are meandering to at the given time. So that's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You get to explore it from both angles, and some of the, and Far Away itself, I mean, it's such a fantastical, wonderful realm, and I love it. It's like basically the threshold of heaven, for lack of a better word. It's as far as you can get up in a positive sense without actually crossing the border into heaven. It's a very wonderful place, and there's I bring a lot of our four-legged and feathered friends into this dynamic. And there's, you know, of course, I have the cats, a lot of cats that appear in it that are companions, mm-hmm. to one of the main characters. And yes, I did think of Sandy when I was, and when I had a scene in it where we show that, yeah, the birds are very much a part of that world and Far Away. And so, yeah, actually, I did think of Sandy while I was writing that scene. So that was quite a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Little tip of the cap.
Hmm. Well, now we can go back into, I know, probably your favorite world is talking about, let's talk about the Rising Dawn saga, the Crimson Rain. It's a world you haven't rode in a while, right? Well, sort of.
Sort of,
but
kind of.
Five.
Yeah. Oddly enough, that's the next biggest book. The Far Away Saga book, probably about 140K in size. This one jumps up to about 200K, so it's a larger volume. It is the fifth book, as you said, in the Rising Dawn saga. And right now at the point in the series, a lot of people I know that are listening, but I haven't read this because I'm going to more or less relaunch the series around this book because it has been a few years, and there's reasons for that. I got into a fog on my first two series after my mother had passed away, so I kind of had to step back because I didn't have my full focus on those series, and I didn't want to just, you know, do them half-assed. So I wanted to wait until I got the fire back to do them properly. And so, yeah, it did take me a few years to get back to writing them again, and I did. And this one is definitely, I think, the best installment in the series. It's called The Crimson Rain, and Rain is spelled R-E-I-G-N. This one, like where the Faraway Saga takes place in maybe 60, 70 years into the future from now, this one takes place just a few years ahead of where we are right now, and very apocalyptic. It's very dystopian. A lot of the action takes place in non-physical realms, spiritual realms, and then also in the physical realm. It's based on the idea of when I say multiverse that we go back and forth between universes, but it is set in a world that's a lot like ours, but it actually is not ours. And that has a part to play in the plot. The fact that it's another universe and it's similar to ours, and then ours actually does finally make a little bit of an appearance in this particular volume. And that's all I can say about that. It's like if you took the radio show Coast to Coast AM and divided it, all the different topics of that, and distilled it, and made one drink, that would be this series. And because you got it all. You have the shadow governments, you have cryptids, you have Nephilim lore. I draw off of mythological lore from all around the world. It's very much a global story. It's also a cosmic story. It's a real heaven and hell type clash. I mean, we really do have, you know, we're talking large-scale Paradise Lost type of clash between a heaven and hell dynamics. I've got a version of hell and heaven that I think are really compelling in it, and the characters that are caught in between. And it's very much a large ensemble on the scale of like a Game of Thrones. It's got that kind of large cast to it. Of course, at this point, you know, I mean, a lot of people are very familiar, you've read it, very familiar with the main core of characters by book five. But, you know, you do introduce, you know, some new things with each book. And so, yeah, you do end up picking up like a new thread here or there. It gets into some pretty intense stuff when it comes to, you know, a very apocalyptic, almost Revelations type setting that's taking place at the history point in this particular series. And it's a, you know, no holds barred, and, you know, involves, you know, quite a lot, and, you know, it's fantastical. It does get, you know, elements of technology and sci-fi along with it, supernatural elements, mystery thriller. I mean, it's really, this one is what I would call a full genre mishmash. It is almost impossible to easily categorize in a single, you know, category. Sometimes people put it in contemporary fantasy. I've seen it put in urban fantasy. And the one I'm most comfortable with is cross-genre, and because it really is. It's a mishmash. But it's a lot of fun. And there's no filler. I mean, the pacing in this one is insane. I mean, the stories move. I mean, it sounds like, yeah, when I say 200K, that's a lot, but it won't feel like 200K. I mean, it's always happening. I mean, the story is chugging on all cylinders, and it's almost tough to put the brakes on it to call a halt to book five for book six here.
What part of this book was the hardest, you say, right, to write? What was the hardest part?
The hardest part is just deciding, I think, what to focus on at a given time, because you've established such a big board of things going on, and they're all interesting. I mean, they all have a lot happening, and they're compelling, and they're all part of the greater story fabric. And one of the biggest challenges in this particular type of writing is just deciding, okay, where do I stop this thread, and what do I need to focus on next? ordering the threads is something I have to give a lot of thought to. You know, what thread follows what thread follows what thread to tell the story. You know, what do you know? Because it's, you know, they're all more or less along the same timelines, but obviously when you're jumping between different threads that are taking place in different parts of the world, I mean, sometimes you have a time overlap in between two threads. So while this thing is happening on this part of the world, this thing is happening at the other part of the world, and how much can you give away in each, you know? And so it's a real tricky thing, and it's something that when I get to the end, I actually do spend a lot of time looking back at the threads, looking at what's happening in each thread, and sometimes I actually reorder the threads in a given section just to, you know, make sure I have that very tight, you know, so I'm not going too far ahead of myself. So, yeah, that's probably the hardest thing is the thread order with all those ensemble casts.
Yeah, with so much going on. Right, right. Yeah, I can understand that. Well, that'll be neat
it
to
does.
See.
Yeah, I mean, all fits.
And then people...
The first four books have quite a bit of artwork in them because that's the time I was able to work with Matt Perry before he moved to California, and he did a lot of great illustrations that were included, and I really hope I can figure out a way to keep some illustrations going for this book five. And I'm not going to get into talking about the figure itself, but that I do have a very intriguing Antichrist figure that I think that folks that are intrigued by Antichrist lore and speculation, I think would be very intrigued by my presentation of an Antichrist concept. I think theologically, I think it has some fun stuff. And that's where the title comes in, The Crimson Reign. So R-E-I-G-N. But, yeah, it's pretty intense. I definitely think people, if they give it the time, and it's not a beach read, something that you definitely want to sink into, but if you really do that, I think you will have an absolute blast. And this was my first series published. I mean, it was Exodus Gate was the first out of the gate, no pun intended, back in 2009. So yeah, this was my first series that hit the ground in the publishing sense, and so yeah, this is fun to see the new installment heading toward port, yeah, and where it's come.
Yeah, it is cool.
Yeah, because there's a mix of characters. Now, I mean, I've got adults, I've got children, I've got in between, I've got non-human characters. I mean, it's got quite. I mean, we're talking ensemble. It's got a mishmash.
Plethora.
Quite a plethora.
Yeah, there's something for everybody. Well, let's talk about the other series that goes back a while with you. This was like your second series, if I'm correct, is the Fires in Eden series, and you have book four. Completed, ready for editing, called Path of Valor. Let's talk about that series.
Path of Valor is also one of those books that is a return to, you know, one of the two early series that I had that I kind of had to take a step back from, you know, when I went through that awful time in 2013. And, but yes, this one, I it just felt so good writing it, returning to the world of Ave, and yes, and that's sounds as it's spelled, A-V-E is the name of the world, and it's got a kind of a Narnia-like element, because it starts in the first book, Crown of Vengeance. You have characters from our world that go through mists, and they find themselves in this fantastical world, but they don't go back and forth. They stay in that world for the duration of the series. So I will say that up front. It's not one of those bounce back and forth kind of books. This one is true. I mean, we're talking, true at the roots. I mean, just classic epic fantasy on all cylinders. And it's, this one definitely gets at my Tolkien roots. And, is a blast to write, because especially since I'm writing with a number of characters that are from our world and time, it's fun for me because, you know, going through their eyes and seeing this great, rich, crazy, very wide-ranging type of world. Now, Path of Valor I mean, it's a large book. It's about 280K, so this is the biggest of the five we're talking about tonight. It'll be, you know, easily an 800-pager in print or so. So, yeah, this is the big book, the biggest book, I should say. And it's also, I think, arguably probably one of the fast-paced ones. And Holly doesn't believe me when I tell her this, but I say it is a fast-paced book. There is not going to be stuff that's going to be, you know, just, oh, my God, this is really dragging, or, oh, they're just wandering around in the woods for 10 days and kind of thing that you see in some series, is, you know, it's where you're kind of like, okay, what's the point? No, this one, I mean, everything has a place, and it is on full throttle at this point in the storyline. And so I call it, I've kind of joked with people, I call it kind of like my Empire Strikes Back in a way, because of the wide range of settings during this one, because we have everything from arboreal kind of environments to in the aerial kind of environments to undersea kind of environments to under subterranean type of environments to, you know, I mean, it has a range of settings that is just crazy in this with the different characters. I mean, they really go through just some really wild and fun settings as the story, you know, takes its next steps. And, you know, and of course, each of the lands is very different, and you get to encounter, you know, you get to experience some brand new lands in this one that have only been kind of hinted at in the previous three volumes. And so, yeah, this is one that really spreads its wings and, you know, takes off from Spirit of Fire and really kind of just, you know, just hits it on all cylinders. I mean, it's very rich, in terms of just the plot, the how much the plot advances, the character arcs, they take big steps in this one. You know, it is a lot of it, a lot of suspense, a lot of intensity, and in this world, of course, if people have read it, you know, it's got some cultures that are very historically inspired and some that are very much invented, and then I've worked to make sure that, you know, that they, that whether they're invented or historically inspired, they have the same depth to each, you know, and so they feel just as real, you know, and so that's and this one, yeah, you do get to explore a couple of those, and, you know, more original cultures that I have, and especially when it comes to, like I said, the arboreal kind of environment, I don't want to give away any spoilers because it's one of the more spectacular parts of the book, but yeah, when they readers hit that section, I think they're going to have an absolute blast. I mean, yeah, I don't even want to think of the budget for adapting this. It'd be absolutely nuts, but it's there's a lot going on in the series, but it's tight. Like, I keep it tight to the, well, you know, it sounds crazy, but yeah, you can keep an ensemble tight, and I do in this one.
Mm-hmm. We've spoke about side characters before, not dismissing them, but if you were going to write a spinoff about a side character from this book, which one would you pick?
Which one would I pick? A side character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, give me a thought. I would like to explore, you know, some of the characters that are native to that world. I think that intrigues me a lot. When it comes to human characters, I love Gunther. He's a really interesting character. He's a bit of a loner, and you know, he's been through a lot of trial in his world, and, you know, and he comes in, you know, kind of gets sucked into everything involving the characters that have come in from our world, and I think that he would really be one that I want to follow on like a side spinoff type of novel at some point. But he has a big part to play in Path of Valor, and where he's heading is going to have people really intrigued for book six or five. I mean, book five. So he's definitely a big part to play in this book, but he'd be one I'd follow. And then, my Dregel from my Trogan Warriors. And he has a big part to play in book four as well. But doing a full spinoff kind of following of his whole story, I mean, would be a lot of fun too, because the Trogan Warriors are very interesting. They're almost like dogmen in a way. They're huge of stature. They've got almost like a like a pit bull type of muzzle kind of facial form to them. So they have a, they're almost like a humanoid dogman type of creature, but sentient and, you know, of course with language and culture and everything like that. And, but they're ferocious warriors. They are just ferocious warriors. And in the storyline, they start out by serving the antagonist, but without getting into it too much, that may change at some point in the series as they learn more about you know, what they've been kind of sucked into. And so so there's a cool redemption dynamic and a lot of other things going on with the Trogons and you know, and then what they've been, you know, deceived into and what they struggle with and what their history has been like. And I've got a very rich history. I've even got a short story of one of their heroes and Chronicles of Ave, Volume 1. I have a story of one of their ancient heroes in that one. But Dragol always is near and dear to me because I think that, yeah, he's one of the biggest heroes in the series. And he has a big, his thread in this one is exciting. I mean, yeah, because he goes right into the heart of the lands where the big mountain trolls come from and where the Trogon warriors, you know, or that whole region and what he discovers and finds there. And so there's a lot that goes on with him in this book that's really exciting. Spinoff, it would be fun to just write with him because of the fact that it is a culture that's unique to the world of Ave. It'd be a lot of fun to mm-hmm. just do a novel on that.
Mm-hmm. What would you describe this series as ideal reader? How would you describe people that should read this series, their likes, dislikes?
I think it's accessible to a YA reader. I do, because it doesn't get too over the top. It's not like my Rising Dawn saga does get pretty, it gets some pretty dark, intense edges to it. You know, things like the Hellscapes, of course, goes even further. But this one is just enough on the boundary line. I mean, it does have some really intense stuff and some dark edges, but it doesn't go so far that I think it would drive off like YA readers. So I think that they're part of it. I definitely think that the epic fantasy reader, this is a feast for them. I've got the kind of book that I personally, as a reader, would just go love to read as an epic fantasy loving reader, would love to read. I've written that kind of book. So I think that epic fantasy readers would absolutely, absolutely love it. But because of the, all the different creatures and lands and things like that, I do think, you know, people that do like sword and sorcery and some of the other subgenres like that, there's plenty to connect to. It's just on a large scale, you know, in terms of the story. But I do think it does span not just epic fantasy readers, but I think also sword and sorcery YA readers would also enjoy it quite a bit. And surprisingly, I've heard from a lot of young readers that love this particular series, you know, who are, you know, have had some as young as 11 and 12 that have read this and loved it and gotten it. It's accessible. But it's definitely the kind of read that you're going to, you know, have to put your attention to because it's got a lot of moving parts.
Right, right. Well, out of all your characters that you've ever wrote, who do you feel you most relate to and why? Across all your characters, who do you most relate to?
This is going to sound like a stock answer. I know it, but it's true. Raiden Valkyrie is the one that I most relate to in terms of, I come from a whole different world and, you know, and I'm a guy, she's a gal and all that. And it's different, you know. But that being said, the kind of spiritual and inner quest that she is on is very similar to the one that I've always been on. You know, she's on that trying to find that path home. She's trying to find the deeper answers. She's trying to, just a couple words just to make it a little simple. She's trying to find God and, you know, find that connection, you know, to what's, you know, what's under everything and what's, you know, the bigger picture of life, things like that. She's got a very yearning, a very deep longing in the very, and she's got a very fiery independence where, you know, she just hates seeing injustice. She hates seeing authoritarianism, tyranny, things like that. Just recoils against it. Just absolutely loathes it. I mean, very, very, very much has a lot of animosity toward those kind of things. I do too. And, I like seeing, individual people empowered, that are, not just people with wealth and influence, and I like seeing individual people get to spread their wings and have upward mobility, and she is very much like that, always, and you see that come through throughout all of her stories. She sticks up for the underdog. She, she will defend those that, are getting, oppressed. She's got a lot of the kind of moral elements about her are things that I really bind with. And I'm not saying other characters don't. There's a character in Fires in Eden, Janice, for instance, who's been through a lot of similar struggles to what I've been through, and I bond very closely with Janice. And before I wrote Raiden Valkyrie, I would have answered Janice from the Fires in Eden series as the one that I'm most closely bonded to. But after she emerged, and after I've journeyed with her, and as of date, three novels and six novellas, I really have come to know her well, and she and I tick on so many different levels. So I think that's the one that I would have to say is probably closest to me in my outlook.
Yeah, I would agree. Clay has a question. He said, what is the boundary line from YA to adult readers? I only have descriptive sex and cursed hearts, but there is bloody violence and implied sex in many mother books. And he said that, he's older and that he no longer knows what the line is. So what would you consider? I say it's a lot of it is subjective, because think about it. There's some young adults that are able to handle more of the violence, more of the graphic sexual nature of things. Then there's going to be some that are triggered. And then you've got some kids that are middle schoolers that can handle reading violent things, but then others could not. So I believe it would be subjective. And this is my opinion. This is not answering for you, Stephen. This is my opinion. But I believe that if you have a minor child, then you need to know what they're reading. And I believe you can decide whether it'd be appropriate for your child or not. I did let my kids read like treasure classics, like, the Oliver Twist and all that when they were in middle school, and Huck Finn and, all that, where I know a lot of schools don't even have those books, don't have Tom Sawyer, don't have, but I wanted my kids to read those. I think it's a part of our history, and I thought it was good for them to read those books. And I did let them read other things, Halo graphic novels and stuff with Noah, of course, and that was more on the violent side and everything. But, yeah, I think it's up to parental discretion. I'll let you answer, Steve, and get your thoughts.
Well, it's kind of like urban fantasy. I mean, YA and what's contained under it has changed, changed certainly quite a bit in the last 10 years. I think that in general, YA tends to skew, in terms of the main characters featured in it, tends to focus on younger characters in general. I think in YA books you tend to find a lot of coming of age stories and younger characters, young adult characters, than you find maybe in other types of fiction. I also think that they don't go necessarily over the top in terms of not going to find things as visceral and graphic and as macabre as you would in a Clive Barker novel, or like a Robert E. Or the kind of violence like in a Robert E. Howard story or something like that. The descriptions are going to be pulled back just a little bit, so they don't too deep into the visceral on that. I think that You know, and I think that but YA doesn't shy away from tackling any type of story. I mean, you can tackle some really dark themes and you know some really intense type of plots in a YA story. But I think that in general, yeah, you pull back a little bit in language and description. And then also, I think, you know, you tend to skew toward, you know, a younger main group of characters for YA. But again, you know, it's kind of it's evolved a little bit, and the umbrella, I think, is larger now. And there are YA books today that are released that I think would just have been classified as mainstream fantasy 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, I've seen it change, just like I have. The definition of urban fantasy, I think, has changed, you know, in the last 15 years,
I think,
too.
It changes, yeah, with society, definitely, the shift. And I find it, Stephen knows this, a lot of our listeners do, but YA is actually my favorite genre. I love paranormal YA. But if I'm going to pick a book up just to have a fun read, like a beach read or just something fun to read if I get a minute, you know, and not exhausted, but and can actually read something that I'm not editing, it's good to just pick up a YA because I don't have to put a lot of thought in it. It's just a fun story. I can fly through them quickly, and it's enjoyable, and it's relaxing to me, you know, to not have to sit and, you know, put a lot of thought into it. Put a lot, you know, it's just they're stories that I like to read. And I enjoy that, and, you know, I find it relaxing for myself. So, I prefer YA myself.
Yeah, I'm reading Clive Barker's Aberrat series right now, and it's YA. It's YA cross-genre, even though, you know, I guess it falls, I call it kind of YA contemporary fantasy, but his Aberrat series is amazing, and it's got every bit of his depth and his cinematic kind of style and everything like that. It's just, like I said, it just pulled back in certain areas. It's not as, you know, it doesn't have, you know, some of the erotic or sexual elements that some of his other writing has. It doesn't, you know, it's got some dark, intense stuff, but it doesn't go too far, like into the visceral, like in Books of Blood. So I guess using Clive Barker as example, you can see a good delineation between YA and non-YA in comparing his Aberrat series with, you know, something like the Books of Blood or, you know, some of his earlier work. So, or like Scarlet Gospels, the last one with the Hellraiser, you know, type theme.
Right.
So, there is
a lot of sexual innuendo you can get by with in YA. Twilight was YA, for goodness sake. You know, there's a lot, and the last book in that series, the sex scene and their honeymoon night, that got pretty graphic, and even in the movies, but that was considered like YA. So I think it has a lot to do with the reader themselves, you know what they can handle, what they can't as a parent, just know what your kid's reading. But, yeah, you can definitely have sexual innuendo. I think as long as it's not a violent sexual act or graphic, like BDSM involved, I think you can get by with, definitely innuendo.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
teenagers
know that people are having sex, obviously, you know.
But that's why I say that, like, for instance, my epic fantasy series, you know, it was released in 2010, you know, solidly, you know, epic fantasy. It is epic fantasy. But that's why I say in 2022 that, you know, I think that there are a lot of YA readers that would find it accessible for that reason, because it's, you know, because YA has broadened and has allowed a little more in under the umbrella than it did in the past. And so that's why I think that, you know, my books are, you know, accessible to a YA audience in that series. It's intense though. I mean, it's a lot of battles, a lot of fighting, a lot of really nasty critters running around that world. So it's good stuff. But yeah, it's accessible, I think, to YA.
Mm-hmm. Well, today's world's horrific anyway, so I think they've seen a lot to begin with. So yeah, they can handle a little bit more in their reading. But what is one piece of advice. I actually want to hear your thought on this one. What advice would you give to help others create plot lines? What's your best advice on creating plot lines?
On creating plot lines?
Yeah.
I think the most important thing is destination. And that's something that I don't get into a book unless I know my destination. Where is it going to end up? Where is it going to culminate? It's okay to have a little breathing room in between start to destination, where you allow new ideas, new things to crop up as you write the book. That's why I consider myself somewhere halfway in the spectrum between a plotter and a pantser, is because, I don't box myself in entirely. I don't over, outline myself. The important thing for plots, I think, is understanding where you want to get to. And then once you have a good grasp of where you want to get to, then you can start, coming up with the twists and turns along the way that'll get you there. And character, the type of characters that you have in mind will also kind of govern that. And you'll find yourself, based on the kind of characters you'll find and their tendencies and their characteristics and the kind of personalities they have, that'll kind of help guide you on the different twists and turns that it will take to get you to that. I don't think it's a good idea to start off without knowing where you're going to end the journey. For a series. I mean, I know where all the series are going to culminate now.
But don't you think that changes sometimes as you're writing? I mean, you don't have to stay set in stone with that ending. You just kind of know where you're going to go.
Trajectory
can change as your characters evolve in the story.
But the problem is that if you go into it without having a trajectory and a destination, then you can write yourself into a corner. And that is the danger of someone who's a total pantser. Is, if you could conceivably box yourself in at some point to where it's just an absolute mess to extricate yourself to make it work.
Right.
I think you do have to have a trajectory and a destination in general.
Right, by giving yourself that idea,
But otherwise, you run risk. Otherwise, I'm not saying it's impossible, but you do run a big risk of boxing yourself in or write, what they used to say, write yourself into a corner. And I think that's some of the problem with some even major writers I've seen, where they have great introductions and great plots that start out and then some of the worst unsatisfying endings. And I think the problem that they had in every case is they wrote themselves into a corner and they didn't have a good grasp of the final. And they allowed themselves to have this good idea to start with, but they didn't know where they were going with it. And then so they have these kind of less than satisfying endings. And I'm sure every reader that's listening tonight could name a few writers that are like that, where the endings are disappointing in comparison to how the plot was unfolding. And I think that is directly a result of, not having a good grasp of destination. So that's just my thoughts on it.
I agree. And then you are more open to let your characters do their thing and evolve, because you know about where you're going. You know where you're wanting to head, and then you can change a little bit as you go. So at least you're not gonna get up against the wall, not be able to go anywhere.
Right. And especially with my ensemble cast and everything, you let yourself have room for new voices to emerge, people or characters, not necessarily people, could be non-human characters, but others that are met along the journeys of your characters. You give room for new voices to emerge, because sometimes, you get into it and you have a very, very interesting character that crops up midway through a book. But you want to definitely leave yourself openings for that to happen. I don't like over outlining and being too tight with that.
I get that. How do you get inside your characters' heads. I mean, what advice can you offer other authors that's having trouble fleshing out a character's thoughts? How do you get inside their heads? What's your trick?
My trick. Like I said, it's for me, my process is almost like I said, getting into a zone where I'm almost watching a movie and then kind of transcribing it. You hear their voices, you see the characters, you see their mannerisms and personalities, and that kind of comes through for me. But I think that the important thing is thinking about the characters, and doing it in a place where you you're not distracted. I think that I have a desk and a computer that is only used for writing, and that's it. It's not even plugged in. It's not even connected to the internet. It's an older computer, but basically, I have created a writing space that is dedicated 100% to writing. And I go in there each day, and when I sit down at that chair, and I put my music on, and I go through that routine. It does something in my head where it switches on, the creative side of me, and it's almost Pavlovian, I guess, in a way. Mm-hmm. I know that when I sit down, it kicks in. And I think that doing things like that help you get into your creative zone, or having a space that's dedicated only to your creative zone, actually can help you with thinking about your characters. Because sometimes I will go down and sit in that chair, and I will turn on, get the computer on, everything. But I won't, I'll sit there and think about a character and just kind of meditate on a character before I write notes or get into a scene or something like that. And I'll meditate on that character sometimes. But I think that being in that my space while doing so really helps that. And so I think that having a dedicated space that you do your creative work, I think, can help you get into the brain zone that you'll need to meditate on a given character and hear how I describe it, hear their voice. And then, like I said, you should keep, however you want to do it, but notes take notes constantly. Keep files if you have, I know there's specialized software for that now. I don't feel the need for it. I just mm-hmm. keep some Microsoft Word docs of notes on characters and plots and lands and things like that. But I'm always jotting down things when I'm sitting there and mm-hmm. kind of immersing or meditating on a character or a scene. But being in that space does create the atmosphere, and it has worked for me over time. Last 15 years, every time I sit down there, boom, it's like a switch into creative mode. And so I do advocate people to try it, at least see if it works for them. But have a space that's only for your writing, that you only do writing at, nothing else. Don't let yourself get distracted by the internet or phones or anything else. Unplug everything else. Have your writing space. That's it. And after you do that for a few months, you're going to start noticing something happening, and that's it. And it works, and for at least for me, it works wonderfully with helping with thinking about characters and books and plots.
Mm-hmm. Well, I we're getting to be about 7 minutes, but there's two more questions I want to get in. So if you'll have to, I really want to
sure.
get these in. Name an underappreciated novel that you love.
Underappreciated novel that I love.
Yep.
Oh, this.
Yep.
Oh, God. Oh, man, you would mm-hmm. ask me these questions, wouldn't you? Underappreciated mm-hmm. novel that I love. I'm gonna go kind of mainstream, since let's see. There is an author who started out as an artist named Wayne Barlow, who I have mentioned in this, who I think is just an unbelievable artist. And he has, done a lot of science fiction and fantasy writing and artwork. But he has two novels. called the first one's called God's Demon, the second one's called Heart of Hell, and they are some of the most fantastical kind of horror fantasy novels that I have ever read. I mean, just amazing. I mean, he's done a lot of look him up, Wayne Barlow, Barlowe, but you'll see him primarily recognized as an artist. And yeah, he is unbelievable. I mean, he did a lot of concept art for like if you remember Avatar, the movie, Aquaman, 2018, Galaxy Quest. He's worked closely with Guillermo del Toro. He was a creature designer in Hellboy, for instance, the Hellboy film series, and did a lot.
And he also writes.
Yeah, but he also turned his focus to writing novels. And he ended up writing just one of the most, and this is going to sound crazy, the book God's Demon is one of the most powerful redemption stories I think you'll ever read in speculative fiction. The title's provocative. It's God's Demon. I know it sounds crazy, but if you read the book, it's one of the most powerful redemption stories, and it's about a fallen angel's quest to get back to heaven. Sounds crazy. I know it does, but it is one of the most powerful, and it is a moving, powerful, just well-written novel that I think that is criminally underappreciated, and I think it is because a lot of people get scared away because it deals with such an intense subject matter, and he's, you know, such a visceral, you know, very vivid artist, you know, writes
right.
Makes powerful, you know, depictions of
right.
some dark imagery, and so people get scared away, I think. But it's actually one of the redemption stories I've ever read in fiction.
Check him out, people. Barlow. But before you give all your social media links and everything before we get off here, I want to know, what is a hugely popular novel that left you thinking you could write it better?
Also, I do want to throw in the most criminally underappreciated writer out there that I think in the fantasy, back in the fiction realms, David Gemmell. Unfortunately, he's passed away, but his works are amazing, and they have just a beautiful spiritual element just underneath the surface, which you can find if you look for it. But anything by David Gemmell. So if I gave you a book, and as a bonus, I'm giving you an author that I think is criminally underappreciated. Now the other question is, what novel could I write?
What hugely popular novel left you thinking that you could write it better?
Oh, well, that'd be 50 Shades of Grey. That'd be easy. I'll give you that one because it's just, oh, man, that was rough. I tried reading, seeing what the hoopla was about, and I got 3 pages in and had to put it down because the writing was so bad. I was like, oh, God, it's painful. But I'm not disparaging people that love it. You know, surely, obviously there were tens of millions of people that loved it, but it was definitely not my cup of tea. But, yeah, I definitely know that at least in terms of the writing, I can improve on that. So that would be my easy answer.
I figured that's what you were going to say. But well,
yeah.
Tell everybody where they can get a Steven Zimmer novel, where they could start, and where they can read more about you.
Well, I'd love you to give me a chance. It's StephenZimmer.com is my website address, StephenZimmer. If you like ancient world kind of stuff and action, I've got my newest release was the compendium for Ragnar Stormbringer Tales, Volume 2. But if you like modern contemporary stories, try Dream of the Navigator. I think that's a fun one to start with if you want to get into kind of my ensemble cast storytelling, and Fires in Eden series and Rising Dawn Saga are larger in their scale, but I think that's a good one to start with for that. Maybe Heart of a Lion, the first of the Dark Sun Dawn trilogy featuring Raiden Valkyrie, might be a good one to start with for the fantasy side of things because that's a very accessible one. and follows a single character narrative to kind of break the ice with you. And if you like that, then Thunder Horizon and When Shadows Fall are the other two. So, yeah, definitely that's just a few recommendations there. And if you like horror, try out my Hellscape stories. Yeah, quite. I think you'll find them very interesting. But thank you, Holly, for mm-hmm. putting up with me tonight. Appreciate it.
Hey, I think we've had a good show. I think you've answered some really cool questions and helped a few writers out there. And some people got to learn more about what you write and what you've got new, you know, getting ready to come down the pipeline. So
lot,
I think it was very successful.
Yep.
You also have, he also has the Steven Zimmer Legion. You want to tell people how
Facebook.
They can join that?
So Steven's mm-hmm. Seventh Legion on Facebook group for those that would mm-hmm. like to join us and follow me more. Yes, I will accept you all. So you'll find me on Facebook.
And Steven's you are still on, gosh, the site has left me. I can't remember now. I don't know. It's left my brain. Where you can pay to subscribe to get, you know, special.
I'm going
to
revamp that. I'm going to revamp all that Patreon
okay.
and everything. Yeah, I'm getting ready to do that.
Patreon, yeah, that's.
But, yeah,
okay.
I think we did it. So, thank you.
I think we did. Thank you all.
If you close us out.
All right. Well, thank you, Steven Zimmer, for being in the passenger seat this week. You've got to be the interviewee. Join us next Wednesday night. We did Thursday this week because I'm still recovering from my con bread. And so join us next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Central Time. And we will have another great guest and do some chatting. And Daniel Dart should be with us. So we will talk to you then. Have a great weekend.